Dysfunctional families are not a modern phenomenon. A father who moved his family constantly and a mother who never settled. An alcoholic father who had multiple affairs. A mother who could not or would not leave, but yet left the children alone while she spied on their father. How much did the serial killer's background shape him? Or could it have been the repeated head trauma as a child? Maybe it's mental illness. Or is it more likely he is a manipulative liar and very good at changing the narrative? This is the case of Thomas Fuller II, and this is Murder Me on Monday.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the Murder Me on Monday podcast. I'm Cameron, and you're with me as Mother.
Hello.
I'm not going to call anyone a dictator this week unless you get a bit angry with me during the recording.
Sounds like a plan.
So with that, a big old thank you to Anastasia and Jeff and Emma Jane for supporting through Patreon. If you want to do that, you can find it in the description below or go to patreon.com/mmom where we do the usual Patreon stuff of uploading it a week early and exclusive content. I've done my bit, you go.
Oh, Anastasia as well, that episode suggestion that you gave me, that's logged. It's going to be a Valentine's Day one. I didn't actually know the case, so I'm not giving any hints.
I forgot where we were in the year there. I thought that was to come. That was like 2 months ago.
Yes, it was. Yeah. So let me take you to Mattoon in Illinois, about 12 miles west of Charleston. Now with a population of almost 17,000, it shrunk a bit after losing a lot of its manufacturing base. It is Saturday, the 27th of April, 1968, a small rented farmhouse just outside town. There lived the Cox family, father, mother, and 9 of their 12 children. The older three, having left home, were married and raising their own families. They were devout Catholics and rather traditional. The older girls were expected to help around the house and do the majority of the chores, whilst the mother tried to keep the peace. Dad worked as a labourer during the spring and summer, and the rest of the time they seemed to exist on welfare and whatever they could grow or raise on the land that they had. Nearly all the children have 2 first names. They're not hyphenated or double-barrelled. So, for the sake of Cameron's sanity, I will stick to the one name only.
Is one called Emma Jane?
No. I think there was an Emma, actually. Oh, dear. Right, the oldest two at home were twins. A boy called Edward Lewis, and a girl called Edna Louise, known as Louise. They were 16. Louise had been dating a boy called Thomas Fuller II, who was 18 years old. Thomas spent a lot of his time at the house, and no one was surprised when he turned up around 9 a.m. that day. They were also not surprised he turned up with a loaded .22 caliber pistol. In the pocket of his jacket, he carried nearly 40 loose rounds of ammunition, in addition to the 6 already in his gun. It was not unusual for the boy to bring a gun to the house. He often went hunting with Louise's brothers. Louise and her slightly younger sisters were doing their chores, making beds and washing the floor and doing dishes. And so Thomas wandered around the local area with 2 of Louise's brothers waiting for her to finish. Thomas was quite taken with Louise, so much so that he had even asked her parents for permission to marry her a few months earlier, but they were reluctant. Thomas was still in school, as was Louise, so they refused, but Thomas seemingly took it all in the spirit it was intended and carried on visiting. Early in the afternoon, Louise is upstairs still trying to make beds when her twin started a physical fight with her and the rest of the family joined in. It could have been play fighting, but it sounded what like we would have called a bundle. There was hair pulling, the lot, and Louise started hollering for help. Thomas tried to go upstairs to help, but the mother barred the stairs and refused his pleas to go to Louise. They argued, and Thomas stormed out of the house, with Louise following shortly after, asking him why he hadn't come to her aid. They ironed that out and go back inside. One of the other girls, who was aged about 14, got too close to a stove and set herself on fire. Although they put it out, she was burnt, so it was a trip to the local hospital to deal with the burns. That's mother out of the house, and father is at another relative's place working on a car. Louise's twin, Lewis, and another brother called Gary, who was aged 7, asked Thomas to come shooting with them out by the old barn at the back of the property. A couple of hours pass. Thomas is in and out of the house a bit, but the others are not. Louise is still not finished her chores when her mother returns from the hospital, being driven by another woman. Thomas asked this woman for a lift into town around 5 p.m, and she obliged, letting him out of the car and watched as he walked down the road south. By 6:30 p.m, mother realises she's missing some of her children and sends the burnt one out and another child to look for them. They can't find them, so she sends Louise out. She's older and probably knows some hiding places the others don't.
Is that one just going to be referred to as the burned one now?
Well, she doesn't get any further referral, poor thing.
When did fireproof clothing become a thing? Because if you just got near a stove and lit up, she dosed in kerosene, was it?
In the 80s, it became a thing.
This was during the 60s.
Yeah.
But why'd she go up like kindling?
But her blouse got too close to the stove and it went up, burnt all her back. It was, I remember, a big thing in the 70s. A lot of children got badly burnt getting too close to open fires when their nightgowns went up. So it was, you know, there was a big rush to put fire guards on open fires because we all had them. Nobody had central, well, very few people had central heating.
I remember back in the day, there was a thing on the television like, do you know where your kids are?
Yeah.
Kids would be out playing until 9 o'clock or whatever.
Yeah.
And apparently kids are getting set on fire.
Yeah. The other children had already looked in the garage, some outbuildings and sheds, but they hadn't checked something called a corn crib. Louise immediately spots her two sisters there, Teresa, aged 9, and Mary, aged 8. They were lying in the doorway, face up, with blood on their heads. Louise bolts for the house, tells her mother what she has found, calls her father on the telephone to come home, with the following call being for an ambulance. Father arrives home to find everyone trying to revive the girls. He is obviously distraught and walks outside to the far side of the barn. And there he finds, in the long grass, the bodies of Lewis, Gary and Kenneth, who was aged 5, all lying there face up, with blood on their foreheads. The ambulance turns up, but all of the children are dead. The girls had been shot 3 times each in the head. Lewis, Louise's twin, had been shot 6 times. Gary, 3 times, same as the girls, and little Kenneth, 1. Local police, county sheriffs, and the state police threw up roadblocks, rings of steel if you were, stopping cars and checking people's ID. They had one very bad picture of Thomas to go on, nothing else. Must have astonished them when he was spotted walking down the middle of the street in Charleston with his gun in his waistband, and he made no attempt to flee when 3 officers arrested him. So who is Thomas Charles Fuller II? He was known to all as Chuck or Chucky, but I just couldn't with that. I had a demonic ginger doll in my head and it was all just too much. 27th of December 1949 at 9 p.m, Thomas Charles Fuller II was born in Mattoon to parents Thomas Sr. and Lucy. He had 2 older sisters and would go on to have a younger brother. Thomas Sr. and Lucy had met when he was 18 and on shore leave from the Navy in 1942. They wrote to each other for 2 years. Lucy was one of 5 children from an Irish family who had emigrated to the US. Thomas was one of 7. They married in Manchester, Connecticut in 1946, and a few months after, Thomas was discharged from the Navy and got a job as an accountant. Things didn't go well. Thomas couldn't keep a job, or what he did find post-war was poorly paid. They moved him with his mother, who hated Lucy. They would eat at relatives' houses to save on food bills. There was an incident when young Thomas was about 18 months old, and Lucy was visiting her own mother in Maine when he choked on a crisp. As he is turning blue, the grandmother is screaming, "Oh no, you've lost him," and generally flapping and being useless. Another relative managed to revive him, stuck their fingers down his throat and managed to pull the crisp out. At home, Thomas Jr. would frequently fall off the sofa and hit his head. In 1951, he cracked his head open on a coffee table, and they were so poor that they could not afford to take him to the hospital. So Lucy was reduced to getting a neighbour and ice packs to try and stop the bleeding, which apparently took over an hour. Thomas Sr. decides to retrain, so money got even tighter. There are frequent moves around the country. Texas, which Lucy hated, back to Illinois, which Lucy hated, back to Texas. Then the drinking, which Lucy hated, and the affairs. He was out 6 nights a week. She either sat at home with the children, which wasn't an option for her, so she would either borrow a car and follow him, or she would go with him when he would go and sit in the local Elk Club, which is like a working men's club. And she hated that too. She didn't drink. She would leave the children behind, all of them, to follow him. She actually got into a physical fist fight with one of his side pieces and sliced the woman's face open with a diamond ring, left scars, and she seemed very proud of that. Thomas didn't get on with his older sisters particularly well, but did seem to like his younger brother. I suspect it's something to do with how Senior treated the boys and girls very differently. The girls were played with, the boys were not. They were told not to be wimps if they hurt themselves and to man up. Lucy was not allowed to physically comfort them if they hurt themselves. And looking into that, it's what we would now call childhood emotional neglect. And it's a huge problem. Not comforting a hurt child is wrong, but it was the 1950s and Lucy did what she was told. Nowadays, there are all sorts of interventions. Back then, it wouldn't have been recognised for what it was. And it's a huge problem. It still happens now. Not surprising, Thomas got into trouble at school, but he also went looking for it. He was frequently on report, often had fights, some of them quite serious, which Lucy seems to have ignored. There are descriptions of him losing his temper and being actually unable to stop hitting the other child he was assaulting. He wasn't liked much. Lucy and Thomas have very different memories of his childhood. His is that his mother was the abuser. She frequently beat all the children and they left home as soon as they could to escape. Lucy says when she was living with her in-laws, she was complaining how her mother-in-law was obsessively jealous of her own husband being around any of the multiple daughters-in-law. And she would be accused of getting up to all sorts, or the mother-in-law would watch these girls continuously so they couldn't be left a moment alone in the father-in-law's presence. No idea if he got up to anything. But it's interesting that Lucy started very similar behaviour towards her own daughters as they got older. She didn't accuse them of doing anything untoward with their own father, but it became a problem if they had anything to do with any men. If a man looked at them, it was the girl's fault, and Lucy would give them hell for it. She also doesn't seem to recognise that in herself, but that's what the daughters do remember. Strangely enough, Thomas actually started to become a babysitter in the area. Not really babies, younger kids. He looked after a lot of them. He called them his army. He was very much into role-playing war games. He was about 14 or 15. And he would have these younger children doing pretend drills out in the woods. Adults found it funny at first, until these children, when they were told off for doing something wrong, standard behaviour, they would threaten their parents that they would tell Thomas. And then they were just like, this is all plain weird. And they stopped using him and the children were kept away from him. And he got really, really angry about that. It meant, though, that he had a lot of spare time, didn't it? He's no longer running drills with these 10, 15, 20 kids out in the woods. He starts making pipe bombs. He is shoplifting and generally getting up to no good, but avoids any legal trouble. His parents' marriage was finally done by 1967. But by then, Thomas Jr. had taken to sleeping with a hatchet under his pillow as he was convinced that his father would come in and kill him one evening. That says a lot, doesn't it? 1967. Thomas, his mother and his siblings leave Texas and they finally go back to Thomas's birthplace of Mattoon in Illinois. And Thomas is enrolled in high school, which is where he meets Louise. And there we are back at the beginning. So after Thomas is arrested and taken to jail and charged with 5 counts of murder, bail is of course denied. May 1968, the district attorney announced that he would be seeking the death penalty. Thomas is given a public defender who promptly complains that it will take up too much of his time and he gets the court to give it to a young, inexperienced lawyer instead, with the first one sort of keeping an overwatching eye on it all. It's actually a smart move. This young lawyer decides that the best defence is pleading not guilty by reason of insanity and throws the kitchen sink at it. He has Thomas examined by not only some of the best psychiatrists and psychologists in Illinois, but in Kansas at the Menninger Foundation Clinic as well. That was a very high profile, big old, you know, that was the place people went.
I was going to say, you could probably try to argue some ineffective counsel thing, but it turns out they've got this little firecracker of a defence lawyer.
Yeah. Well, he does later try and blame him, but that's the standard as defence.
He's gone above and beyond. The first one was like, eh.
Yeah, I don't want to do this. When the interviews and tests were done, they amounted to well over 1,000 pages in the transcripts and reports. Also taken as part of the examination were several encephalograms, which were brain wave readings. The first, in Springfield's Memorial Hospital, detected, and I'm going to struggle with this one, diencephalic epilepsy. This diencephalic epilepsy is a form of epilepsy which causes the sufferer to fly into a rage during a seizure, which was new. Oh, and all those head injuries as a child. Apparently, these scans didn't show any sign of damage from them, which I find rather surprising. I wondered if maybe more modern equipment would find them, but...
Because they wouldn't have had MRIs, would they?
No.
So it's just going to be an X-ray or yes, whatever they can see to get it. So they're not actually going to be able to see soft tissue. They're just going to see your brain case, your skull.
Well, these encephalograms, which are brainwave readings, you wouldn't expect them to... brain readings. Yeah, them things.
Yeah, but they're just a reading. They're just the interpretation of how your brain is working rather than the actual image of itself. Because you have some people that... I mean, you get some people that get shot in the head and wake up with a headache. Yeah. Like, a week later, they go to the doctors and like, you've got a fucking hole in your head. How do you not realise? What do you mean?
Yeah, I know.
When the radio gets turned on, you start hearing colours. What do you mean?
14th of October, 1968. The trial starts. And Thomas throws a curveball by changing his plea to guilty.
Can counsel say, retract that?
The counsel was probably sat there with his head in his hands. The judge had to spend quite some time talking to him to make sure that he understood exactly what he was doing and what the effects of him pleading guilty would have. The judge became convinced that Thomas knew what he was doing, and then set a hearing for the 4th of November, which was a sort of a mini trial. Both sides using much of the case that they had planned to introduce at trial, but the big difference is that the hearing was held solely to determine the sentence because he'd pled guilty. Testimony from a psychiatrist at the Messenger Clinic. Latent schizophrenia. Yet from what I've read, that's supposed to develop in people aged between 40 and 60. Not having any transcript, I've no idea if the word latent had been added incorrectly at a later date. I don't know. Thomas's interview tapes with the police were given to the court, where he admitted he must have done it, but he had no memory of doing it.
I don't think the word latent refers to like a chronological age, because it's to do with like the duration of something. I mean, we Googled it in between there because there was a long pause. It's lying dormant or hidden until circumstances are suitable for development or manifestation, or existing but not yet developed or manifested, hidden or concealed. So you think it's added in incorrectly because it's latent, which would usually manifest in people at the age of like 40 when they should have like started to experience it in the age of like 20, is what I assume you mean.
Yes. Because you would not be surprised with schizophrenia manifesting itself in an 18-year-old and to 26-ish.
And then the latent part would be in the 40s, which stuff would have usually happened, but it's happened later.
Yes.
But I'm thinking, is the term latent used in a way to describe post these events that happened that would have then generated schizophrenia in this boy, the brain damage, the abuse, the whatever, and then he's had a seizure, apparently, that makes him go into like a fugal, aggressive state, along with this girl that he's obsessed with, the whatever.
I don't know.
And that's then like kicked it in. But you could be right that it's just the word latent is incorrectly chucked in.
I went digging to find the origins of that. I really did struggle because as soon as I saw it, I thought that's a weird way of putting it. That was the defence, remember though. The state psychiatrist said that Thomas had a schizoid personality, saying that he had the ability to coordinate his thinking, but refused to do so. On the 13th of November 1968, this was all over. Now, the only motive ever alleged was around a weird idea that Thomas may have thought he was helping Louise from the oppression of her parents and brothers and sisters. You know, she was being put on by the family. And that motive never really sat to either the defence or the DA. And since Thomas never took the stand, and he also never fully cooperated with the psychiatrists, that was the only rough idea that they had. The judge set a date for sentencing, and on the 10th of December, after reading everything, I mean weeks and weeks and weeks of paperwork, he took the death penalty off the books, saying that he did not deem this to be an appropriate case for the death penalty. He cited Thomas's age. I mean, for God's sake, he was 18. Shouldn't have, yeah. His lack of criminal record. I think that's only because he didn't get caught. And the conflicting psychiatric testimony. So there's stuff hidden in there that I haven't been able to get my hands on. And he sentenced Thomas to 5 terms of 70 to 99 years. With 2 of the sentences, which were for the girls' murders, to run consecutively. But the others were concurrent. It's all academic.
That's just trying to hit the word count for saying life, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, you're not wrong. But Thomas would be allowed to apply for parole as he was sentenced under old rules.
When he's 312.
Well, no. You have to serve a minimum term. And then these rules were changed in 1978. If you got a life sentence, you're no longer allowed to apply for parole. But he was. And oh boy, did he. 15 times.
Wouldn't you though?
Well.
I mean, he did it. So, but yeah.
It may be more. The last one I can find is 2014. And he was told to wait until 2018 before applying again. But I can't find anything after that date. I have no idea how I found this case. It's a serial killer. I'm 100% sure no one except locals and the victim's family have ever heard.
Is it a serial killer?
Yes, he killed 5.
Is it not a...
A spree killing as well. He's a spree killer. 5 in one incident.
I know we went to like a whole seminar type thing a couple of months ago about it, but I don't remember it now.
Yeah. Well, it's the serial killer is down to whether you believe who in the FBI, whether it's 2 or 3 murders. But then you've got the spree killing, which is one occasion. So if you killed 5 in one town and then drove to another town and killed another 5 there, it depends if it was within, say,
the time span,
whether that would be classified as a spree killing. Which goes to when we did Hungerford and things like that.
Because I guess this is, you're a serial killer, but it's a spree because it's not pathological. It's in the moment type thing. It's not a...
Yeah. Well, it's like Hungerford when he killed all the people around Hungerford. That's the, and Derek Bird when he did everybody up in Cumbria. That's the spree killing because it's all continuous part of the same. He hasn't gone to bed, gotten up, and gone off.
What did his family do in this time?
What with Thomas's family?
Thomas's family do.
Well, his mother was having connuptions and fating everywhere and left, right and centre. And I think his sisters and his brother were like, oh, hell no. God knows what dad was doing.
Well, they'd moved away by this point, so.
There's nothing out there. I'll call it a book from 1982. It's published. It's a book written by Diane Sawyer. And I've no clue if it's the famous American TV news anchor. Nothing to indicate it was. This woman, Diane Sawyer, she apparently knew Thomas's mother, Lucy, but hadn't put together the murders and her, which for a reporter, which is how she described herself, was a bit odd. It's only 102 pages, this book, so it's more like a pamphlet. There are a few news reports about appeals and there are a few trial papers. And I did find a blog from the murdered children's father. It revealed that he'd given up on the Catholic faith as he couldn't get any answers. The local priest had told him that five children were with God and he needed to pray to get them out of purgatory, which made no sense to me or to him because the purgatory is the in-between state, isn't it?
It depends which sect of Christianity, because it's where some of them we're in purgatory right now. That's the thing.
Well, the Catholics, I don't know. And Tom, the children's father was really, really angry about Thomas not being executed. He stormed out of the court when the verdict was given. He was very much an eye for an eye type of thinker. There were also some really rotten rumours flying around the town. And some people still wonder if Louise helped Thomas. There were accusations of pregnancy, which were obviously false. There were accusations that the children's father was a drunk and a womaniser. All sorts of drama. And Facebook isn't the only bloody place. Small towns haven't changed since ever.
Especially when they're in the middle of buttfuck nowhere.
Yeah, exactly.
In the 60s.
Yeah. The father, he converted to a Jehovah's Witness afterwards. He passed away in 2010, the children's mother passing in 2006. And they did leave one heck of a legacy. Now, they had 12 children, didn't they? They lost five, which, yeah. They ended up with 28 grandchildren, 70 great-grandchildren, and 12 great-great-grandchildren. The book I mentioned, it was an eye-opener, though she reveals in it that according to what Thomas told her, he'd written a number of books. He wrote three before trial, handwritten. And all his journals, there were dozens of them, they were written to fool everybody that he was mentally unwell. He claimed to her that he had the journals brought into prison for him before the trial, and he would take them apart. He would unpick them, rewrite massive amounts, and then sew them back together and have them taken back out. Now, it's certainly true the penmanship and colours of ink change on these papers, I believe. But equally back then, there was no testing would have been done on these. They wouldn't have had them. Maybe they also as well could argue that the changes in writing style, the colours of ink and all of that was down to his schizophrenia, maybe. This Diane Sawyer, this author's final takeaway, is that she feels Thomas was badly treated. She apologised for signing one of the many petitions to keep him in jail a few years previously. She claims to have stolen one new petition while passing through town and threw it out the car window and thinks that he should be let out. She also takes multiple pot shots at people in this book for their looks. The DA is fat and balding. He may be, but it's irrelevant.
You say that about the people that have killed people. I know that once you've done something bad, you kind of lose any charitability, so you can kind of slag off how they look. But you do that, you say, yeah, she looks like, well, I say she looks like a potato that's rolled in some dirt.
You say it. I don't tend to. Yeah, occasionally. You do. One of the petition signers was described as pimply and pasty. Yeah. We talked about this applying for parole, which is allowed under the rules, but I probably think it's maybe unnecessarily cruel. No lawyer, if they're getting paid for it, is going to turn it down. But every time he gets put up for parole, he gets his hopes up. More than once, he's been convinced that he had some sort of ace up his sleeve. The what he doesn't reveal to the book author, but he's always eventually still denied parole. The parole board doesn't think that those journals are fake. They are still citing them as a reason to turn him down. Thomas himself had written that he had planned to kill the family as he was saving Louise from them all and was going to take Louise to Canada. Obviously, there's no mention if Louise had ever said she'd wanted to go to Canada. And the problem still is he refuses to talk about the motive. And the authorities are probably hung up on that. He also won't talk about Louise, but that could just be to that Diane Sawyer who wrote the book. So we have this epilepsy. No word if he is being treated for it. The schizophrenia too, same problem. Yet I also can't find anything that says he was a problem in prison. And you would think that if he had such a rotten temper, he would have exploded more than once inside, wouldn't you?
It can be very different though when people are subject to structure. Yeah. Regime. Often people that have certain conditions, they do quite well with it. They don't need to think. That's part of the routine and they become adapted to it. If you're put outside, you're no longer part of it.
He obviously isn't institutionalized mentally in that he's had at least 15 goes at trying to get out. We talked about he's not really institutionalized. Thomas has actually been downgraded very early into his sentence, in about 1974, I think, and was given some cushy jobs and sent to a swanky new facility because he'd been such a good prisoner, which the victim's fathers found out about and actually rang the prison and demanded that he be sent back to a stricter regime.
But they didn't have grounds for that, though.
No, they took no notice. But the parole boards did take notice of the many petitions. And the family who survive and friends still attend the hearings to make sure he doesn't get out.
I mean, I guess that's kind of why it goes back to the courts and the government that deal with this. Because as humans, we're obviously naturally biased. The victim's family, or the victim's dad at least, was an eye for an eye type mentality. But if that's the case, you wrong me, I wrong you back. You wrong, you wrong, you wrong. And then
I think also as well, the problem was that the death penalty was on the table initially and they probably did expect it for five murders.
Yeah.
But then he's 18 and I struggle with that. I struggle with how much of this was caused by his absolutely dysfunctional childhood. But again, that was what he went through was not actually that uncommon for that time.
And also wasn't that severe for that time either.
No.
In terms of how bad it can be. We've done 100, this is the 105th case we've done. There've been about 50 that have been way worse than his childhood that didn't do as bad as he has done, which it to me feels like he's projected his experiences with his abusive father and then abusive mother as well, if whatever side you want to believe.
And that's why I think he's a manipulative liar, because he's gotten this so-called reporter who wrote this 102-page book to completely turn around what she thought about had actually motivated. Well, she still doesn't, she admits herself she doesn't know what the motivation is because he won't tell her. I think he's a manipulative liar. He had his reasons. He knows what those reasons are. And even though he keeps going through the motions about trying to get parole, he's in a really good spot. He's in a really good spot. He's got a very cushy life in prison. I hesitate to use the term respected, but he's one of the old timers. There's never been any reports of any kind of violence from him, getting into fights, none of that.
I know in our society we tend to punish people more severely that have harmed the more vulnerable, children, elderly, women that are pregnant, etc.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a slight discouragement as well. You don't mess with the people. There's that stupid thing about you have to save the women, children and orphans first.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. But he went for the youngest kids that were there. He went from people aging from the age of like 5 to 12 or something, wasn't it?
5 to 16. Yeah.
Yeah, so he went for the youngest ones there rather than the parents, which are the ones that he could attribute the blame to, because they're the ones that are in charge that are forcing the daughters and the children to have this life when all really they're doing are chores And then he wasn't allowed to see them at one point when there was an argument that broke out. That's kind of what it stemmed from.
He's lashing out as in he will punish the parents.
Punish the parents by punishing the kids, which haven't done anything wrong. Which is why, to me, it's odd that he's gone for the kids.
Yeah. But also as well, look at it this way. How did he manage to do it? He shot the two girls first, it's believed. They were shot three times in the head. And then he had the boys round the corner of this corn barn. Lewis, the oldest, which was the twin, which was the one who started the fight with Louise with the hair pulling and the rough housing earlier that day. He got six bullets. How did he stop them running, screaming, getting away? How did he manage to pull this revolver and reload it and shoot them so fast? There is something missing from how this all happened that we're not being told. And nobody,
yeah, true.
Yeah, it's just... I thought about it afterwards. Five people. How do you immobilise five people long enough for them, you know, so you can
kill
them?
I'm assuming it's a six-piece type revolver. So short of it being one shot in each, then reloading and then going back again, I can't see how you'd do that.
Again, that's entirely possible. But and as I suppose as well, because they were used to shooting, it was mainly rabbits and occasionally birds, which they he used to shoot for fun. And Louise didn't like that. I like Louise. But they're going to shoot rabbits because rabbits are food. So I guess if they'd heard gunshots going off, they just might think someone's just taking shots at a rabbit or a bird. So maybe they wouldn't have... I don't know. But like you say...
I guess that screams to the issue of people being conditioned to hear gunshots and not expect anything of it.
Yeah.
It's like a fire alarm that goes off in your house constantly. After a while, you don't pay attention to the fire alarm when there is actually a fire. I kind of want to briefly discuss it as well before we... And the way that his father would treat him and versus the daughters.
Yes.
People have this weird concept of what toxic masculinity is. What his dad did to them is toxic. It's when when a little boy falls over and he said, oh, don't be a pussy, don't be such a girl. That's it there. These are all the toxic manifestations of what masculinity is.
Big boys don't cry. Of course they bloody do.
There's a reason why you tell these girls... when they're young, you're so pretty or whatever. Then when they grow up and they're kind of what they lose their looks and they feel like they lose the value of what they might provide in society, that it affects people, women very negatively. Whereas with the guys, you're a smart fella. So they've kind of never attributed their self-worth to looks, for example. And this is just kind of like an antiquated thing that we have in society.
It's getting better. It's a long process.
Well, you say that, but the fucking bald twat Andrew Tate is making it way worse.
Yeah.
People consider it an immutable characteristic where you're like an attractive person, so therefore you're of value. That then wanes as you get older, so therefore they think women have a time limit on them.
Yeah.
And with man, it's the only way you can provide is with money and protection or whatever. That'd be funny, but we live in the 21st century. It's not the same thing anymore. He kind of didn't. This is going back in the 60s. But his dad having that mentality of... you're a man, you need to behave this way. I don't show you love. Whereas with the girls, you kind of can because they're played with, because they're different. There's a reason why male suicide is so high. It's because they feel like they can't actually discuss emotions and how they feel, because you kind of need to do that. That makes you a healthy individual. His dad contributed to this massively. You said he lashed out as a child when he's at school. Well, yeah. If he doesn't get affection and attention from like his mother and his dad, and his mum has been kind of told you can't show that, because if you do, then she gets in trouble, even if he hurts himself. So the only time he gets attention is when he lashes out. That's why kids that are neglected at home lash out at school, because it's then some kind of attention.
Sometimes, not always.
Yeah, because sometimes kids are fuckers.
But Lucy, his mother, the story that she told to this reporter, and bearing in mind this reporter knew his mother beforehand and seems to have had sort of like a friendship with her, it was a very self-serving interview that his mother gave. She was the wronged party in all of it. Everything was the father. She just reacted to what the father did. Now, don't get me wrong, I think the father was an absolute piece of...
Well, if you're complicit in the abuse as well, you're part of the abuse. If you don't stand up and stop it, that's the bad apple analogy. You can't have just some bad apples.
But according to all the children, Lucy wasn't any better than the father.
Exactly. So she's got this bias. That's where it goes.
Yeah.
Like I said earlier, you can't trust... the individual, with bias, we have our own narrative, what
exactly.
We think is true versus what objectively is. And yeah, I just wanted to say that it's the way that he's brought up has kind of led him to be in this. It's not an excuse, he did it. Like, I'm not saying remove any individual responsibility, but that's contributed to it. But and then he's attempted to, or at least maybe a weird deformed sense of protection, killed the family to try to protect her.
Yeah, it's like a white knight syndrome that's not fully formed.
No.
There's no logic. Where does it go? Yeah, we're going to go to Canada. What the hell are you going to do in Canada?
It's that thing I've said, A equals B equals C, therefore A equals C, if that's a follow a logical trend, and if it's kind of A equals triangle, question mark, what? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any sense.
No, I've got no idea how I found this. I've got no idea. It's not out there. There's no TV shows about it. There's not even a proper book. You've just got this 102-page pamphlet that's out of print. But Goodreads, managed to read most of it. So there he sits in Graham Correctional Centre in Hillsborough. And that's the last place I can find he was there. Thomas Charles Fuller II, aged 73, in prison for 55 years and counting. And this is a very similar, the childhood neglect angle, to the next Patreon episode that I've got all written and ready to go. We've got to find time to record it. And that's the end of this week's episode. Finally, the victims who should not be forgotten. Edward Lewis, aged 16. Teresa Jean, aged 9. Mary Catherine, aged 8. Gary Lee, aged 7. And Kenneth Winford, aged 5.
So that's the end of the show. Thank you very much. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Murder Me Monday Podcast. Email us at murdermemondaypodcast@gmail.com. Patreon in the description below. And we'll see you next time. Peace.
Bye.